This is Free Speech Radio News for January 1st, 2004. I'm Deepa Fernandez. On today's show, we bring you a special documentary remembering 10 years of Zapatismo. Please stay with us. Ten years ago today, on January 1, 1994, a primarily indigenous rebel group, the Zapatista National Liberation Army, or the EZLN, declared war on the Mexican government. They yelled, "Ya basta, enough," to the authoritarian government and announced that NAFTA, which went into effect the same day, meant death to indigenous peoples. Throughout the following decade, the EZLN has been a key reference for anti-neoliberal and anti-racist struggles around the globe. On the 10th anniversary of the uprising that shook the world, we bring you this special documentary remembering 10 years of Zapatismo. This special is produced in the Chiapas Indie Media Center by Mariana Mora, Luz Ruiz, Tim Russo, Rachel Wallace, Alex Rocklin, Abby Smith, Ana Maria Moscoso, Jose Juan, and Jimena Antillon.
On January 1st, while the rest of Mexico was celebrating the start of the new year, and President Carlos Salinas de Gortari, along with the country's political elite, were toasting the implementation of the North American Free Trade Agreement, the EZLN was mobilizing to take over five major towns in the state of Chiapas. Shortly after midnight, poorly armed women and men took over the towns of Ocosingo, San Cristóbal, Altamirano, Las Margaritas, and Comitán. The uprising was a shock, even for those who for years worked in the very communities where the rebel army had been secretly organizing.
By 1992, what we saw was a very complicated panorama. We saw all of the peasant organizations divided and fighting with each other. Nothing is ever going to happen here, I thought. On January 1st, I was driving home and was stopped by dozens of armed men. "Cabrones," I yelled. "Where the hell have you been? We've been waiting for you."
Gaspar Morquecho, a local journalist who now owns a bookstore in San Cristóbal, recounts the first hours of January 1st, 1994.
The central plaza had already been taken. I became more drunk than I already was, and the Zapatistas just looked at me. Then a curious thing happened, something I didn't expect. All sorts of people arrived and began to talk to the armed men and women, to ask them questions, to ask what they wanted. They approached the Zapatistas because they were sure that the war wasn't directed against them. Those conversations happened throughout the first part of the day.
Within less than 24 hours, that almost jovial spectacle turned into full-fledged warfare as thousands of Mexican military and police forces confronted the rebel army and terrorized civilian populations. In one indigenous village, Morelia, all of the men of the community were rounded up and three elders were assassinated. Sister Patty ran a small popular hospital in Altamirano and was accused by the military of hiding weapons in the San Carlos Hospital. She remembers that day.
On the 5th of January in the afternoon, the Federal Army arrived. It was a day of incredible silence, an environment of great fear. The military began to give out food to the people, and when the families went to receive their food, many of the men were taken by the military, tortured, and taken to the prison Cerro Hueco.
During those 12 days of warfare, approximately 200 people were killed, most of them civilians. The images broadcast throughout the world of the corpses of poor indigenous men lying on the dirt with wooden guns by their side made people wonder what was behind the decision to risk their lives. In February 1994, the Zapatistas again entered San Cristóbal de las Casas, this time to begin the peace negotiations. From the cathedral, Comandante Cebedeo spoke about the importance of peasant and indigenous people's right to land.
We decided to go to war so that the peasants could have land, not the ranchers. It wasn't for one village nor for the state, but rather for everyone who doesn't have land.
Again, Doña Rosita.
There exists among the people of San Cristóbal a feeling of racism, which is viewed as very normal. During the first interviews after the uprising, the people here were asked, "What is your opinion on the situation?" And they said, "Well, this is a very serious problem, because really we have always lived like this, with the Indians and their communities, with their tranquil way of life, and us here. The Indians understand very well that they are Indians, that they have to live this way, that we live in another manner, and there has never been any conflict."
It was against this racism that the Zapatista communities decided to take up arms. In the words of Comandante Tacho,
It was at the dawn on the 1st of January 1994 when we appeared, because of the conditions and the situation in which we live, here in these mountains. We rose up in arms, not so we could have somewhere, an office or some other important place to go. We took up arms so we would not be killed by forgetfulness, so that these demands would be heard, and that they would see that in this corner, in this country, Mexico, there are indigenous people who have been abandoned for many years.
The EZLN was officially founded 20 years ago, on November 17, 1983, in a remote guerrilla camp in one of the farthest corners of the Lacandon jungle. Subcomandante Marcos, military leader of the EZLN, describes what those years were like.
When the first group arrived in 1983-1984, we were in the densest part of the jungle, in Montes Azules. We were talking about a group of four or five, six people that repeated to themselves every day, "This is the right thing to do, the right thing to do." There was nothing in the world telling us this was the right thing to do. We were dreaming that someday all of this would be worth something.
Marcos was referring to the fall of the Berlin Wall, to the considered failures of other rebel and guerrilla forces throughout Latin America, and the crisis of alternative models. All of these pointed to the apparent impossibility of success and to the need to rethink revolutionary politics.
The compañeros arrived at a time when the peasants weren't interested in the ideas we had. We felt we knew the truth. We felt enlightened by our ideas of justice and social change.
Eventually, the primarily urban, foco-style guerrilla group learned from the local indigenous communities that enlightening the masses and teaching the poor about their own oppression would not work. Subsequently, a fundamental political transformation occurred within the EZLN. Again, Subcomandante Marcos.
It was after 1986 when that contact was made. That was a decisive moment for the EZLN, when it began to be a student and not a teacher. It was no longer about teaching what is a revolution, but rather about learning what is a social movement.
If the first transformation occurred prior to 1994, the second major political transformation of Zapatista politics took place on January 12, 1994, when the rebel army agreed to a ceasefire. During the first 12 days of full-blown warfare, hundreds of thousands of people in Mexico and the world took to the streets, calling for a peaceful solution to the conflict. From that moment onward, the EZLN attempted a series of negotiations with the government on one hand, and focused on political projects with sympathetic members of national and international civil society on the other. In August 1994, the National Democratic Convention was held in the heart of rebel territory in the community Guadalupe Tepeyac. It was the first time the Zapatistas and civil society met face to face.
In a way, we expect civil society to tell us what to do. We have to do something. We need to speak with all those people that want the same thing as us. We need to sit down face to face and reach an agreement, see what it is we all want. That is the idea of the National Democratic Convention.
More than 6,000 people from all corners of Mexico, forming a 10-kilometer caravan, traveled for hours down narrow, muddy roads until they reached the site of the meeting. Once night fell, Comandante Tacho inaugurated the event.
Brothers of the National Democratic Convention, in the name of the Revolutionary Indigenous Clandestine Committee, General Command of the Zapatista Army of National Liberation, we wish to welcome you to this place, which is now called Aguas Calientes.
A silence fell in the open-air auditorium while thousands of Zapatista support base members marched with white cloths tied to wooden sticks.
These compañeros are our supporters in struggle. They have been and continue to be the backbone of the EZLN. They are the ones who fed us, who protected us secretly. They are civilian representatives. They are just like you.
Marcos then spoke about what was expected from the National Democratic Convention, an expectation that today defines how the Zapatistas engage with civil society in their struggle.
We hope that this National Democratic Convention creates a peaceful organization that struggles for democracy, liberty, and justice. We want it to be clear that this is only one step, that there are many more steps to come, including under more difficult conditions.
A few weeks after the National Democratic Convention, presidential elections were held and the Institutional Revolutionary Party, the PRI, who had been in power for 65 years, once again won the presidency. One of President Zedillo's first actions was to issue apprehension orders against the Zapatista leadership on February 9th, 1995, Comandante Tacho.
The government of Ernesto Zedillo launched a military offensive in order to find the EZLN leadership. There were thousands of soldiers, and they mobilized in helicopters. It was very difficult because people had to leave their communities and hide in the mountains.
Michael McCaughan, an Irish journalist, was in the Zapatista community of Morelia that day. He describes what happened.
I was in Morelia on the 9th of February in 1995. The night before, they advised us that the army was coming. In Morelia, they already had the experience that when the army came on the 7th of January, that they killed and tortured people, that they destroyed things. There was a lot of fear there, and also a lot of anger. So on the night of the 8th, there was a feeling somewhere between panic and indignation. Suddenly, where you had seen people going about their daily lives, harvesting corn, putting the kids to bed, 15 minutes later you had a uniformed army, armed in the basketball court. And suddenly you realize that this is war, and that this is an army, and that here anything can happen.
The Mexican military was unable to capture any of the rebel leadership, even though the offensive forced dozens of Zapatista commanders to seek refuge in the mountains for several weeks. By March, an amnesty had been called, and both parties agreed to begin the first round of peace talks on indigenous rights and culture in October of 1995. The San Andrés Sacamchén de los Pobres peace dialogues began. The Zapatista leadership and its advisors negotiated with government representatives from October 1995 to February 1996. Before agreeing to any decisions, the Zapatistas consulted with their support bases and respected the consensus they reached. Comandante Tacho.
This general document that you all know about will be submitted to a consultation by our support bases.
The communities received the proposal, as described by an anonymous community member.
As support bases, we have reached this conclusion, and we will continue to study and analyze this document. That is the order that we have given our authorities.
After a long series of discussions, an agreement was reached and the first round of peace accords were signed on February 16, 1996. The San Andrés Accords, as they are called, recognize indigenous peoples' rights to self-determination, autonomy, collective use of natural resources, and bilingual bicultural education, among other rights. However, the government showed little desire to continue the peace talks during the next round, which focused on democracy and state reform. Images captured on video show government representatives combing their hair and yawning as Zapatista representatives spoke. At moments, the blatant racism and lack of commitment and respect seemed almost humorous. Again, Comandante Tacho.
They told us that they are studying what is meant by dignity, that they are analyzing it. They are carrying out an assessment on what is dignity. We told them that they should continue their study.
By September 1996, the EZLN had suspended the peace talks. Not only did the Mexican government and President Zedillo show little interest in reinitiating peace talks, rather they increased the level of repression. Since 1995, over 60,000 Mexican military troops have been stationed in the conflict zone, patrolling, intimidating, and encircling the population. President Zedillo's military stepped up the ante, supporting the creation of paramilitary groups. Paramilitaries in the northern zone and in the highlands, in particular, targeted and assassinated Zapatista civilian supporters. The most horrendous event took place on December 22, 1997, in the highland village of Acteal, where paramilitary groups, murdered 45 Tzotzil Indians as they prayed for peace inside their local church. Despite this physical enclosure by the Mexican army and its factions of armed supporters, the EZLN continued to focus its energies on constructing relationships, networks, and a series of dialogues with civil society. Escaping the threat of death and repression has depended on it. Zapatista Major Ana Maria speaks to the importance of this contact with sympathetic sectors of Mexican and international society.
In the first year, the war was born, and we began to travel this road that brought us to the hearts of all of you, and that today brought all of you to our heart.
Several gatherings between the EZLN and civil society took place. The Intercontinental Conference for Humanity and Against Neoliberalism was held inside rebel territory in August of 1996. More than 4,000 people from 42 countries met in the Zapatista Centers of Resistance, called Aguascalientes, to discuss the impacts of neoliberalism and the multiple forms of resistance. Major Ana Maria gave the opening speech in the Zapatista Highland Village of Olentic.
Brothers and sisters from all corners of the world, welcome to the southeastern corner of Mexico, where we are all the same because we are different. Welcome to the search for life and the struggle against death. Welcome to the first Intercontinental Conference for Humanity and Against Neoliberalism.
For 3 days, representatives of popular organizations met in working groups to discuss the social, economic, political, and cultural impacts of neoliberalism and to share experiences of struggle. They discussed and shared opinions, laughed and danced in the Aguascalientes of Morelia, Oventic, La Garrucha, Roberto Barrios, and La Realidad.
First of all, why would a union from Brazil, which is so far from Mexico, decide to send representatives to this intercontinental conference? Because the globalization of the economy and the neoliberal project require us as civil society, as people that have a different vision of life, to organize and unite in order to propose and search for other constructions of life and history.
A participant from Brazil voiced the general sentiment that brought many to this remote jungle town, a dire need for people from all over the world to discuss and propose alternative projects to neoliberalism. Diverse groups of people struggling against neoliberalism have since held other such gatherings throughout the past 10 years. The spaces of conversation have taken place in venues like the World Social Forum in Porto Alegre and through mobilizations against corporate globalization in Seattle and most recently in Miami. Besides the intercontinental gathering, the EZLN has organized a number of other major events. In October of 1998, the Zapatistas held a gathering with civil society in San Cristóbal de las Casas. There they announced the popular national referendum on indigenous rights and culture to be held throughout Mexico's 2,500 municipalities in March of 1999. Then in 2001, during the March for Dignity, 24 Zapatista comandantes and subcomandante Marcos traveled through 13 states to participate in over 77 mass gatherings. Andres drove one of the buses during the caravan. He remembers how people in the towns along the way received rebel commanders.
We participated in the caravan. We were the chauffeurs of the comandantes. We were in charge of bringing them there. We realized that it wasn't the subcomandante who was in charge, but all the supporters of the EZLN. And it was really beautiful because the people backed them. We would go through towns, and there wouldn't appear to be any Zapatistas. But in the moment of the reception, wherever you wanted, they popped up, even where there were no towns, but they popped up, like an army of ants.
The March for Dignity culminated with the rebel commanders addressing the Mexican Congress. Comandante Esther, a Tzotzil indigenous woman, towered 4 feet 10 inches over the Congress and gave an unprecedented speech.
Algunos habrán pensado que esta tribuna sería ocupada.
Many people thought this congressional podium would be occupied by Sub Marcos, and that he would be giving the Zapatista central message. Now you see, this is not so. Subcomandor Marcos is just that, a sub-commander. We are the commanders, those that govern together, those that govern obeying our peoples. Now is our time. There are those that represent the civilian sector of the EZLN, the political and organizational directive of a legitimate movement, honest and consequential. And furthermore, we are here to demand the law for dialogue, reconciliation, and peace with dignity in Chiapas.
Participants during the March for Dignity and other events persistently demanded compliance with the first round of San Andres peace accords, an end to militarization, and, more recently, the suspension of neoliberal projects like the Plan Puebla Panamá and the Free Trade Area of the Americas. The autonomous municipalities epitomize alternative projects envisioned by the Zapatistas and their supporters. Approximately 42 autonomous municipalities exist throughout Zapatista territory. These municipalities have their own form of government structures and commissions that have created alternative education, health, and agricultural projects. Javier, a former member of the autonomous government in Poló, explains.
Before we would ask the government to give us everything, a few sacks of corn, some clothes, and tin roofing to build our houses. But now we realize that we can do things ourselves, with our own ideas and from our own history. The communities constructed the autonomous municipalities so we could make our own dreams our reality. We're not asking the government for anything, we're asking for our right to dignity.
Members of the autonomous municipalities reject any form of assistance from the Mexican government. Instead, they construct alternatives with their own resources and look towards their own histories of struggle to construct a future. For the Zapatistas, the struggles against racism and against neoliberalism and the construction of autonomy are clearly linked. As organizer and former political prisoner Jorge Santiago explains,
no se van a resolver.
The structural problems of communities are not going to be resolved if they do not take a global view. All the people of San Andres have gone down this road, and there's a clearer concept of what a situation of dependence, of dominance, of exploitation signifies. And in this sense, the alternative has to be different. The alternative is not collective work on its own, but the construction of autonomy, with the direct link between autonomy and resistance. There are two tools. If there is resistance, there is autonomy. If autonomy is achieved, so is resistance. They are interrelated.
One element of autonomy is the construction of autonomous education projects, as explained by some autonomous education promoters.
The government teachers don't teach well. We started the autonomous education project so we could have our own culture and tradition. That is the objective of autonomous education.
Since we are autonomous, we teach what is ours, what is the truth. The children are enthusiastic and we are in resistance. The teacher is Zapatista.
Now that we have our own education, we don't teach just so the children learn more or move up a grade, but so that they can teach others in the community.
In August of 2003, the EZLN Autonomy Project reached a new level of maturity as the Zapatistas announced creation of the councils, or juntas of good government, which incorporate the rotation of representative seats from all autonomous municipalities. Journalist Germán Bellinghausen explains.
This new phase of autonomy clearly proposes that the Zapatistas govern their territories. We can say that all the positive and negative experiences of these years have culminated in a model of government for this entire region, which includes all the autonomous municipalities.
Viva los caracoles en resistencia!
These councils of good government are coordinated in the center of five Zapatista regions, referred to as caracoles. The caracoles replace the previous name of the centers of resistance, Aguascalientes. In the new Aventic Caracol, a three-day celebration was held in August to recognize this new phase of autonomy. Thousands of Zapatistas and non-Zapatistas from other parts of Mexico and the world met in Aventic to dance, greet each other, play basketball, and celebrate the caracoles. In the words of Comandante Rosalinda, who was present in Aventic,
we have resisted more than 10 years. Our primary means of struggle is our organization. We have our autonomous councils and our municipalities. And now we have the Juntas of Good Government. With this, we have taken another step.
The Juntas of Good Government are designed to resolve the needs and conflicts of the local population. These new government bodies are not exclusively for Zapatistas, as Comandante David explains.
Non-indigenous and non-Zapatista brothers and sisters that live within our territory, we want to tell you that it is not necessary to be Zapatista to be served. You have the right to be served and listened to as long as you are a member of the community or the municipality.
As part of these new structures was an explicit call for women's rights. Comandante Fidelia spoke specifically to the men.
We call to the men of Mexico. Don't put your sad faces. We're not demanding, nor we're asking for favors as women. This is obligatory.
This new phase of autonomy changed the relationship the autonomous municipalities have with the Zapatista military structure. Subcomandante Marcos explained that the military authorities will not participate in these governing bodies.
Hermanos y hermanas, los felicitamos por el nacimiento.
We congratulate the juntas of good government. Now those juntas will be the authorities. The EZLN won't speak for a government, even if it is an autonomous government. The EZLN speaks for the governed. We will be ready to defend you.
In a communique issued prior to the celebration, the EZLN critiqued the paternalistic attitudes of non-indigenous sympathizers supporting the autonomy process. The juntas were partially created to change these relationships. The sympathizers are welcome as long as they respect the decisions of the municipalities. Comandante David.
For that reason, we tell you to continue coming here to teach us and share with us, but above all, to learn from us. To learn the good and not the bad from us.
Viva la resistencia mundial!
This new phase of autonomy does not intend to separate and isolate the Zapatistas, but rather to change how outside actors engage with indigenous communities. By changing the way interactions take place, the Zapatista project of autonomy forms part of broader anti-neoliberal struggle. Again, Comandante David.
With our resistance and rebellion, we wish to make a small contribution to the struggles against neoliberalism and against the globalization of death.
Ruben, an indigenous human rights defender from Chiapas, was recently in Miami, demonstrating against the free trade area of the Americas. He tells us how global struggle has managed to cross borders with common goals.
I wasn't in Cancun, but I was in Miami and I liked it a lot. What I realized is that all of the different struggles are globalizing. I can always say that I'm going to a march to support communities organizing in San Cristobal, or a march in my village, or in Tuxtla, to demand the release of prisoners, or that they recognize indigenous rights, but that's here in Chiapas. After being in Miami, I realized that there is an infinity of struggles of different forms taking place in different cities and towns all over the world. In Miami, I felt the same as if I was marching in my community, or as if I was here in Chiapas, marching for the same rights.
A decade to the day has passed since the unlikely, ill-prepared Zapatista rebel army stunned the world, capturing the hearts and minds of peoples from across the globe, and still, the words of Major Ana Maria resound in the humility and humanity of the Zapatista struggle.
Behind our black face, behind our armed voice, behind our unspeakable name, behind those of us that you see, behind... we are you.
Remembering 10 years of Zapatismo was produced in the Chiapas Indie Media Center by Mariana Mora, Luz Ruiz, Tim Russo, Rachel Wallace, Alex Rocklin, Abby Smith, Ana Maria Moscoso, Jose Juan, and Jimena Antillon. Tomorrow we'll be back with our regular newscast. And to all our listeners, a very feliz Año Nuevo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.